Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back. First postseason edition of the Crossover Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. Howard, did you have a good weekend recovering, rejuvenating, getting ready for the offseason?
I slept. I slept a lot. And then after I woke up, I went back to bed. And then we went to the beach for a little while. So I think I'm recovered.
A little family time.
I don't think we have a choice. We have to be recovered. The draft is coming. Free agency's coming. The NBA summer is just an insane, chaotic ride. And here we go.
Yeah, I was thinking that the other day. It's really not till mid-August when you can really power down for a few weeks. Mid to late August before you can really shut down. Because then, like, second week in September, you start to pick it up again, get ready for training camp. But it's like a three-week window where you can kind of really...
There was a time, Chris, I'm old enough to remember. You may even be old enough to remember. When the NBA summer was actually kind of sleepy, right? Summer league wasn't a thing. There were a bunch of summer leagues, not one big one where everybody on earth was gathering. And they weren't that important. And free agency wasn't a 24/7 exercise. But yeah, those days are long gone. And the NBA loves it this way, by the way. They absolutely do. And for all of the NBA's, I think, more performative hand-wringing about tampering, they don't mind it that much. Because the fact is, everything is news. Everything is driving social media streams and shows and podcasts like this one. And if the NBA could be a 12-month-a-year show beyond the basketball, they're more than happy about it.
Nah, the NBA loves being in the news cycle, and as long as they can be in the news cycle, they'll take it, no matter what the subject matter is. As long as it's largely positive, they want to be in that news cycle. All right, Howard, we got the draft coming up on Thursday. I got Jeremy Wu joining the show a little bit later on, so we'll do draft coverage there. You and I are going to talk about some of the juicier free agency topics that have come up over the last couple of days. And I want to begin with Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn. The Athletic reporting this week that Kyrie and the Nets are at an impasse when it comes to contract negotiations. Kyrie has a player option next year for $36.5 million. He wants a new deal. The Nets probably want a new deal, but they want a deal that is one that they're comfortable with. I wrote about this over at SI.com because this, to me, felt wholly predictable. You know, where we're at right now with Kyrie and the Nets not close to finding common ground, we should have seen coming. And if you didn't, you weren't reading the tea leaves enough. They were pretty obvious out there. I mean, you go back to May when Sean Marks had his postseason press conference after the Nets were broomed out of the first round by Boston. And Sean Marks sat there on the dais and he used words like, we want players that are committed. We want players that are selfless. He didn't single out Kyrie Irving, but anyone with a functioning brain could tell that he was sending a direct message to Kyrie Irving, who missed a large chunk of the first half of the season because of his unwillingness to get vaccinated. He was only a part-time player in the second half of the season because of his unwillingness to get vaccinated. And the Nets don't want to go through that again. I mean, right now, COVID-19 is not front burner in New York City, but fall is coming, Howard, and you never know what can happen in the fall if cases start to rise, hospitalizations start to rise. New York City, very liberal city. You could see Eric Adams, the mayor, institute the same kind of vaccine mandate that was in place last year. So the Nets, they're no longer screwing around here. The question is, you know, what do you take away from the reporting that Kyrie is at an impasse with Nets? Because to me, certainly not knowing the source of the reporting, this felt like Kyrie Irving's team softening the ground a little bit out there, putting it out there to put some pressure on the Nets to suggest that there are other options for Kyrie that are available.
Yeah, it came across very much like a leverage play by Kyrie and his camp. And again, as you said, this is not to doubt anything about the reporting that brought this to light in the last couple of days. But listen, we've all been doing this a long time. Like, sometimes it's just pretty clear that some of the framing is, you know, being created by one side. This framing that Kyrie himself is the one who's saying, well, or that Kyrie feels that he's going to explore these other options. What other options? So he's trying to create the idea of leverage with the Lakers and the Clippers and the Knicks when none of those three teams have salary cap room. If he opts out, he's now got to deal with the market as it is. The teams that have cap room or can get there, or needs the Nets' participation in a sign and trade. Granted, the Nets will be incentivized to do so. But you are now introducing a massive number of variables. Do any of these teams actually want him? And how badly do they want him? And since they don't have cap room and would have to do it via sign and trade, what are they willing to give up in a trade? Are those things that they're willing to give up things that the Nets actually want? And on top of that, are these teams, because of salary cap machinations, if you acquire a guy in a sign and trade, you're now subject to the hard cap, which means it's a lot harder to finish building out your roster, which for the Lakers in particular, I'd say the Knicks too, but especially the Lakers as a team that's trying to be a contender, would really, really hamstring you to be hard capped by taking a Kyrie in a sign and trade. Not to mention the fact that it was only 5 years ago that Kyrie Irving forced a trade away from Cleveland to leave LeBron James when they had just gone to three straight finals and won a championship. Why on earth do we believe that Kyrie now wants to go back to LeBron James, or that LeBron James would want him back? And I mean, there are just so many holes in this, Chris, that it's almost maddening to read this and to have it be presented with a straight face, like, oh, Kyrie's not happy with the way contract negotiations are going, so he may explore his other options. He has no other options, at least no great ones. And we can talk about who actually has salary cap room. They're not teams that Kyrie would even want to go to. I mean, and let me just run it down real quick before I stop here. These are the teams that absolutely have cap room, and none of them have the $40 million that Kyrie could make as a max. The Pistons have about $28 million. These are all per our good friend Bobby Marks. Detroit Pistons have $28 million. Kyrie Irving's not going to Detroit. The Orlando Magic have $25 million in cap room. Kyrie Irving's not going to the Magic. The Pacers have $25 million. Kyrie Irving's not going to Indiana. The Spurs have $29 million. I don't think the Spurs and Kyrie are a marriage. On the next tier, per Bobby Marks, the Grizzlies could get up to about $19 million, but it means parting with Tyus Jones and Kyle Anderson. The Blazers could get up to $36 million, but the Blazers they've got Damian Lillard. They're not bringing in Kyrie. The Wolves, Knicks, and Wizards could all create some room. But again, it's offloading salary. It's basically sacrificing guys for just for the sake of making room. Where is the path here for Kyrie Irving's actual leverage in free agency? It doesn't exist. It's BS. He and the Nets need to figure it out, or they need to at least figure out he needs to at least opt in to his final year, and then the Nets can figure out where to trade him, and presumably to a team where they are interested in the return package.
Yeah. The Knicks, to me, are the most intriguing team of all this because, as you said, they, while they don't have the cap space now, there are some relatively workable maneuvers they could make to get the available cap space to sign Kyrie. And we know New York is just desperate for star power. Like, they wanted Kyrie 3 years ago, coming off the disappointing season that they've had, and the fact they've had a glaring hole at point guard since really the 1990s, I can see the Knicks, Leon Rose, that team being interested in signing Kyrie Irving. Now, you could obviously make the same argument the Nets are making, that availability could be an issue. Any type of vaccine mandate in Brooklyn would affect Kyrie Irving in New York. So that's a lingering issue. But they're the team out there that I would, if I'm the Nets and I'm nervous about losing Kyrie outright, they're the team I would look at. Because everybody else is not just looking at Kyrie's inavailability due to the vaccine, but his body of work really since Cleveland, where he was self-destructive during the end of his time in Boston, where he kind of ghosted on his team midway through his second year for a few weeks, where is like, we go back to the vaccine again. His unwillingness to get the vaccine cost his team a chance to develop the kind of chemistry it needed to be a true championship contender. I don't see all those other teams that have real cap flexibility being willing to do that. And unless Kyrie is willing to take that $10 million extension or exception, which he could get from, what, the two LA teams and a whole bunch of teams across the league, which would effectively be leaving, what, $26 million on the table for next season. Unless he's willing to do that, his options are extremely limited. So I don't see that happening. But New York, whenever I talk to teams about New York, there's just a feeling that this could be the offseason that the Knicks do something kind of crazy, that they act kind of Knicks-y in a way, where whether it's going out and clearing cap space to bring in Kyrie Irving or making a godfather offer to Utah for Donovan Mitchell, there's just a sense coming off the year the Knicks had that they could go out and just go for it, go big to try to get into the middle of that playoff mix and make themselves relevant once again. Kyrie, Donovan Mitchell, those are the kind of players that make that happen. So I don't know how you feel about that, but I think the Knicks, to me, are the most of the strongest candidate. Look, and I'm not saying they're a strong candidate to get Kyrie, but the strongest of all those teams to get into the Kyrie mix.
I mean, the desperation is certainly there. And Chris, we've seen this over the years, no matter if it's Leon Rose in charge now or Phil Jackson or Steve Mills or whomever. At some point, everybody tries to do the slow and steady methodical thing for a bit. And then at some point, Jim Dolan starts rattling people and getting impatient and stamping his feet. And the Knicks start making rash win now moves and bringing on guys who are late in their career or have injury histories or have character issues or whatever. Like, yes, that is the pattern of the Knicks over the last two decades. And no, it wouldn't surprise me, even though, to his credit, Leon Rose during his time in New York so far has tried to be careful, conservative, do this slowly. But, you know, well, they overachieved
the Cam Reddish deal. The Cam Reddish deal was kind of that was one of those, like,
but,
I don't know.
But
the disconnect that was there between Thibodeau and Leon Rose.
There was a disconnect. But that disconnect, at least from the front office level, was about, we see the opportunity to get a young guy with a lot of upside who's still a recent high draft pick. Let's take a swing. We're sending out a low first round pick. It's worth a shot. That Tibbs didn't play him is alarming because it shows that you're not all on the same page. And this has been another perpetual issue with the Knicks over the years, right?
They also went out and did the Fournier Kemba Walker deals, which Fournier has now become an albatross around their neck, to the point where they may have to give up draft capital to get rid of. If they want to clear space to get Kyrie, they may have to attach a draft pick to Evan Fournier to get rid of him.
Yeah, and look, you're not wrong, Chris. I mean, like, there's a little bit of the win now mentality, first in hiring Tibbs, which we discussed many times before. In hiring Tibbs at all, you went for the win now coach, and then you signed some win now guys in Kemba and Evan Fournier, and it didn't work out. They didn't actually win now. They, in fact, regressed, which is what puts them in a more desperate position this summer. So, yes, the case is there. I still give this front office the benefit of the doubt. Who like, aside from the Nets who have just lived this, the Knicks have had the best front row seat to watch this chaos unfold across the river in Brooklyn, that they would be the ones, having granted, missed out on Kyrie and KD as a tandem a few years ago, that they would be the ones to see where this went and go, oh yeah, 3 years later, we still want Kyrie Irving at this massive number and at the cost of having to offload some of our veterans to dump their salaries and possibly picks to induce teams to take those players. Like, that's not actually getting them anywhere. And I think this front office, unless they're under insane pressure from ownership, which, by the way, always possible, but unless that's the case, I think this front office is smarter than that, wiser than that. I don't think they would go down this road. I don't think it solves any problems other than, sure, it gives them an incredibly talented player to re-energize the roster and the fan base momentarily. How long it lasts is anyone's guess. Because let me throw in one more factor here, Chris. You talked about COVID, the vaccine, all the stuff that Kyrie did to torpedo the season for the Nets last season. It's not just that. I was doing some quick math on Kyrie Irving's overall participation in the course of his career. He has played in 611 of a possible 866 games in the regular season in his career. That's 70%. He has missed 30% of his career. Now, take out last season, which was obviously unusual because of COVID and the vaccine. Eliminate that season. He has still only played in 74% of all games in the regular season during his career. That's the equivalent of about 61 games per year in an 82-game season. That's bad. And by the way, when we're talking about the market for Kyrie in trade or free agency, don't think that all these other teams aren't also looking at that. Whether he disappears for a couple weeks as he did the season before this one, because he wasn't feeling it and decided to take a two-week vacation in the middle of the season, or whether it's because of his injury history, the fact is he's often not available, and teams are not going to want to pay a premium to take that risk on both his health and his level of engagement.
No, they're not. And to add more math into this, and I included this bit in my column on SI.com, yeah, he was brought in to be the complement to Kevin Durant. There have been 247 scheduled games that the Nets have had where Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving theoretically could have played in together. They have played in 58 of them. Now, a lot of that chunk miss came during 1920 season, rather, when Durant missed the entire year with that lower leg injury, recovering from the Achilles tear. But in the games they played, they are 34-24, very average number, 7-13 in the playoffs. So it's not like they're blowing the doors off in the postseason. So it hasn't worked out, you know, with Kyrie and Durant playing alongside each other. Now, all that being said, Howard, you know, as I said at the top of this, as, you know, predictable as this impasse is, I think it's just as predictable that the Nets and Kyrie come to some kind of agreement, one way or the other, because they both need each other. You know, Kyrie needs the Nets to provide him with a big contract on a contender to play with a guy in Durant that he publicly says over and over again he wants to play with. So he needs the Nets. Similarly, Brooklyn, which has $111 million committed to six players next season, that's without Kyrie Irving. They lose Kyrie, they get nothing back in return. Then you go into next season with a core of Kevin Durant and Ben Simmons, along with Joe Harris and Seth Curry and all the other pieces around there. But you're not a championship contender without Kyrie. With Kyrie, theoretically, you are a championship contender. So these two sides, they need each other. So it seems to me that while we're discussing the dysfunction of the situation right now, a month from now, I think we're talking about Kyrie agreeing to some kind of deal with Brooklyn that brings him back for the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, and here's the thing, Chris, because you have heard, as I have, this notion that, well, if things are truly breaking down with the Nets in terms of a contract extension, he can go somewhere else. And among the possibilities, well, what if he did just take somebody's mid-level exception, $10 million or something? It's the most illogical thing in the world. You're not giving me the $40-plus million a year I want over a long-term deal, so I'm going to go take a one-year $10 million deal somewhere else, and I'm going to leave the city that I most wanted to go to, New York, and I'm going to leave the player that I most wanted to play with, Kevin Durant, over a contract negotiation breakdown, when the fact is the Nets' position, if we can just surmise a few things here, is really about them trying to minimize their risk. Fewer years and probably less money than he's eligible for, because they need to protect themselves against him breaking down or going astray or who knows what else. And so he could be pissy about that, and his camp can put out their things about, like, we're going to go somewhere else, but it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless the Nets also decide, you know what, we're done with you, because he stands to lose too much money to just simply walk away. And again, he's not going to leave New York to go sign with Orlando. That's just not happening. The one thing he has in his corner, and people have noted this, and they're not wrong to flag it, is that he and Kevin Durant came here together, they're friends, and presumably Kevin Durant will still take up for Kyrie, much as he did during the season, where he had every opportunity to criticize Kyrie's decisions that really torpedoed their championship hopes, and Kevin Durant didn't. But I would say that's a far cry from saying that, well, if Kyrie leaves, if things break down on contract negotiations and he either walks away or they trade him away, that suddenly you're going to lose Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant is a lot of things, one of which is very, very smart, especially about basketball and about team dynamics and about what it takes to win a championship or a couple. Don't you think on some level Kevin Durant probably, and we're all mind reading here, so let's acknowledge that. But I've got to believe that at this stage of his career, having come back from an Achilles tear, having performed when he can play at an MVP-type level, Kevin Durant probably, I'm going to say on a competitive level, would not be heartbroken to lose a guy who is completely unreliable. He still wants to have a team around him that can contend, but like the idea that, well, they're friends, so you can't alienate Kyrie because it alienates Kevin Durant, give Kevin Durant a little more credit than that. I like, friendships in the NBA are what they are. At the end of the day, if you want to win championships, that takes precedence. And Kevin Durant's only got, you know, whatever finite number of years left to perform at this level and contend for titles. And you said that, you know, like, if you lose Kyrie, you're not a contender anymore. I would argue the opposite. I think, as I've said before, having both Kyrie and Ben Simmons introduces way too much volatility to this roster. I'm going to pick one or the other. I'm not going into next season with both if I'm Sean Marks. And if it means that Kyrie's going, if you can count on a healthy Ben Simmons to anchor your defense and be your primary playmaker, he and KD and some role players, maybe that's enough. Because, by the way, the last four champions in the NBA were non-super teams. The Raptors won with Kawhi Leonard plus some really good second-tier guys, Kyle Lowry, Pascal Siakam. The Lakers the next year went with LeBron and AD. That's two supreme players, but a late career LeBron, and Anthony Davis is, I don't know what to make of him anymore. But it's not a super team. It's two guys. Bucks win the following year. Giannis plus second-tier stars. And now that we just saw the Warriors win with Steph Curry plus, I'm going to say, second-tier stars, because there's no other like explosive guy on that roster. Klay Thompson still getting back. Draymond Green is a different kind of player. These last four teams that won championships are non-super teams. I would argue that the Nets do not need to be loaded over the top with top-tier talent of Kevin Durant, Kyrie, and Ben Simmons. Two plus a really great group of role players should be enough.
Could not disagree with you more. And I'm glad you said this, because this opinion befuddles me. If the Nets right now were a stock, they would be Bitcoin, basically, at this moment. What they could be is Apple. Like, the Nets,
I almost spit my
Apple
water over my microphone. That wouldn't have been good.
The Nets have a huge upside, I believe. One that is being completely overlooked in the midst of this dysfunction. I just told you how many games Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant played together. Ben Simmons has played zero with all of them. He is a 25, soon to be 26-year-old former All-NBA point guard who has played zero games with them. Joe Harris has not played with them. Seth Curry has only played a handful of games with them. You're just not going to convince me that a lineup of Ben Simmons, Joe Harris, Seth Curry, Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant is not a championship contender next season.
I'm not saying they're not, but I'm not convinced they are either.
Okay, but what you're arguing is they're better off without Kyrie Irving in that.
No.
I think that's crazy.
I'm not arguing necessarily that they're better off, Chris. What I'm arguing is it does not take a super
team.
Roll
the tape.
Hold on.
That's what you argued.
It is not. No. What I'm arguing is it does not take a super team to win a championship right now. We had a super team era that dominated every finals from 2008 when the Celtics of Pierce, Ray Allen, and Kevin Garnett won, all the way through the Warriors' run until Kevin Durant left. So from 2008 through the 2018 championship or the 2019 finals, that's the super team era. Where we are right now is four championships in a row that have been won by teams that are not, by definition, super teams, that are not overstocked with three or even four all-stars. And what's that shown is that in today's NBA, at this moment, until further notice, until somebody else manages to pull together a different super team, you actually have an opportunity to win with either one supreme player and a bunch of great role players, or maybe two. And if Ben Simmons gets back to that all-NBA level we've seen before, Ben Simmons plus Kevin Durant plus great role players. By the way, you're leaving out the fact that in this scenario, you've probably traded Kyrie for something decent that's going to help bolster that supporting cast.
Not much. You're not going to get anything but nickels on the dollar in a trade like that. You're just not. Like, if you're dealing with the Knicks, maybe you get Evan Fournier back, which completely cripples your defense. Maybe it's Alec Burks in that mix. They're not going to give you RJ Barrett in a trade like that to get Kyrie Irving. I just think that's pie in the sky. Look, your point about super teams, let's make a Star Wars analogy here, all right? The last couple of years have been like Star Wars 4, A New Hope. Next year could be The Empire Strikes Back. That's what it could be, when the super teams rise from the ashes. And I'm including Golden State, which could very easily. Golden State could become a super team again very quickly. If they move some of their younger pieces, they could add a Bradley Beal or somebody else, or Kuminga could turn out to be a really good player right away. James Wiseman could turn out to be a really good player right away. The Warriors very quickly could become a super team once again. And the Nets, with only mild changes to the roster they currently have right now, could be a super team once again. They do need to get more athletic on their bench. They need to get more guys like Bruce Brown. They need front court versions of Bruce Brown, which I'll grant you do not grow on trees. Like, those guys are very difficult to find. You can't
and they
go into
could
next
lose
year.
Bruce Brown.
Right. They could. But you can't go into next year with a front court rotation that includes LaMarcus Aldridge and Blake Griffin. You just can't do it.
No.
That's not tenable for a championship team. But I think it's baffling how dismissive most people are, not just you here, but how dismissive most people are of a team that will include Kevin Durant, who would have been an MVP if he played the entire season, or at least been right there in the top two or three.
Agreed.
Kyrie Irving, Ben Simmons, Joe Harris. Joe Harris and Seth Curry, two of the top five best shooters in the NBA, top seven best shooters in the NBA. Statistically, Joe Harris is the best when he's out there, and Seth Curry has proven himself to be an elite shooter at this level. So you've got two great shooters, two elite scorers, and Ben Simmons, who can defend everybody and play multiple positions. Like, I can't fathom why that team shouldn't be considered the frontrunner. That's a team, Howard, that could very easily win like 65 games if all things fell into place. Like, they really could. They're just as likely to me to win 65 games as they are to win like 42 and get beat in the first round.
If all things fall into place is doing a lot of work in your sentence there, Chris.
It's fair. It's fair.
So, Kevin Durant, since coming back from the Achilles, of course, misses an entire season. Since he's been back, played 35 out of 72 his first season back, played 55 out of 82 his second season back. This is what happens when you come back from an Achilles rupture. It's not just, can you play at your old level again? Can you still be elite? Can you still be an all-star? It's also, how often are you going to get hurt, and how many games can you play, and what's your durability? And like, the recent history suggests that you can't count on Kevin Durant for a full season, which, look, to argue against myself, is actually an argument for keeping Kyrie Irving, because you need somebody else to generate offense if you're going to assume that Kevin Durant might miss 15 to 20 games. But that said, we also have enough proof that Kevin Durant plus Kyrie Irving plus everything else going on in Brooklyn just hasn't worked to the extent that, like, listen, even when they've played together, and granted, this may just be the chemistry issues that were caused by Kyrie being gone so much, but their offense was stagnant as hell against the Celtics. Like, they practically swept themselves. There's too much talent there to have gotten swept by the Celtics. The Celtics are really good. They should not have swept them.
I know you're a fan of Steve Nash, but they need a new coach. They need a new coach. Steve Nash got clobbered. He got clobbered in the playoffs. Ime Udoka coached circles around him in the playoffs. And look, if you reverse the two teams, the Celtics were just better at that point. They had more chemistry. They were peaking when the Nets were stumbling. But Steve Nash is not the right guy for that job. He's just not. I think, you know, that team would have been so much better off if they had kept Ime Udoka and just elevated him instead of keeping Steve Nash.
I am not here to cape for Steve Nash as coach. I would say, like, if of all the things that we're listing about,
You are Steve Nash stan is what you are. I know this about you.
We did like the same fish taco place in Manhattan Beach, which I think is gone now.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
Rest in peace to Wahoos. Love that place. So, look, Nash may not have been the right choice for this, but that's immaterial. He's like not in the top five of things that went wrong for the Nets last season, because the top four are all Kyrie, and the fifth is James Harden, and the sixth is Ben Simmons not playing despite kept continually saying he was about to play. They had no defense. That's, you know, sometimes a function of coaching, but in the Nets case, it's a function of the roster. They had this creaky old front court. They had no rim protection. A lot of things went wrong, and maybe Nash didn't help. And I will be the first to say, if your offense is that stagnant and predictable and isolation heavy, the coach needs to take a lot of responsibility for that, because either you didn't do more to make it more dynamic, or you tried and the players didn't follow directions, in which case, even if it's not your fault, it's still your fault. Like, or you're still the responsible one, because now you need a coach who they'll listen to. I don't know that Kyrie's going to listen to anybody. Kyrie, from day one since he got to Brooklyn, has been like, you know, didn't have any use for Kenny Atkinson. Steve Nash gets hired and Kyrie says, no, we're all coaches. Doesn't mention Steve Nash when he's running down the list of people who will decide what they're going to do as a franchise this summer. Names everybody but him. I mean, like, that's a problem. Then that's not Nash's fault that Kyrie's decided he's, you know, not worth his time, apparently. But Nash is not in their top six or seven problems.
Well, look, I'm very interested to see what they do with other roster moves. If they bring back Bruce Brown, and whether it's through a second round pick or free agency, get somebody in that front court. I mean, Nick Claxton's a guy they should bring back, too. I know Nick Claxton had some atrocious free throw shooting games, but he's the kind of versatile front court guy I think they need on that team. But if they can find one or two more guys like that, and you're not wrong to say it is a heavy lift to get there, that all things work out. But look, Ben Simmons will be off for an entire year. You give him a full training camp at full health. I'm very curious to see what he brings to the table. You bring Kyrie and Kevin Durant back without the vaccine mandate kind of looming over them as it was during last year's training camp. I'm very interested to see what happens there. I think this Nets team has a huge upside, a massive upside that is not so improbable you can't believe it's possible, if that makes any sense.
Let's agree on this much then, because I think you will. They are the team with the biggest span, the widest possible array of outcomes. They could be spectacular. They could be an absolute disaster again, because they're going to if they bring everybody back, the core group back. And listen, again, I'm an advocate for at least offloading one of the two wild cards. I don't think you should go into a season with two guys as unpredictable and unreliable as Simmons and Kyrie. But if they keep both of them, the potential for this team to be really great is there. The potential, because of all the volatility and unpredictability and injuries and everything else, the potential for another very disappointing season is also there. I don't know that there's a team with a wider range of outcomes right now than the Nets.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All right, couple of things I want to hit on before we go. One of the more interesting free agent targets out there that could be readily available is Zach LaVine. LaVine, of course, Bulls all-star, had a terrific first half of the season, got injured, some issues in the second half. He is eligible for a 5-year max level contract extension. For a while, Howard, during the season, it felt like this was just going to be It was going to fall in line. It was just going to happen for Zach LaVine. But as the season played out and you get into the offseason, you start to hear some things about the Bulls and maybe a line they'll draw on his contract. Our friend Casey Johnson reported back in May that it was not the slam dunk, to borrow the basketball metaphor, that some would expect LaVine to be backed. My thing with Chicago is that, look, LaVine's an excellent player. I just don't know what the Bulls want to be. I don't. Because I look at that roster, and I see a roster that is guaranteed to make the playoffs every single year for the next 3 years. DeMar DeRozan is a really good player. Vucevic, who didn't play that well this year, is a really good player. LaVine is an excellent player. Lonzo Ball, whose absence was really felt in the second half of the year. They really missed Lonzo Ball in the second half when he was injured with the knee problem. He is an excellent player. I just think they have a ceiling, Howard, and that ceiling is not the NBA Finals. And if that's the case, is it worth investing a five-year max deal in a player like Zach LaVine, who, in addition to not being able to carry you to the next level, is injury-prone? He's got a history of knee problems. So you could be dealing with that at some point during this contract. What's your take on the Bulls-LaVine situation and how available you think he is? Because if he is available, that's a team, that's a player rather, I think Portland could get interested in. That's a team, or a player that Sacramento could get interested in, that San Antonio could potentially get interested in. There are teams that are going to be out there willing to offer Zach LaVine at or close to the kind of money he's looking for.
Yeah, and then, of course, there were always some murmurings, too, about, like, how did he feel about DeMar DeRozan coming in and playing the conquering hero role and getting a lot of offense and all that. And, you know, you can never tell, like, you know, sometimes those things are overblown. Sometimes there's smoke where there's fire, or fire where there's smoke. I think it was Jake Fisher from Bleacher Report who recently reported that it's now expected that Zach LaVine's probably staying in Chicago. I mean, look, you're not wrong, Chris, that on paper, and especially when you look at how strong the East is, we just talked about the Nets' potential. You've got the Bucks, who at full health are going to be contenders again, absolutely. The Celtics are here to stay. The Sixers, with a full season of James Harden, presumably an in-shaped James Harden, they're up there. The Raptors are rising again. The Heat, probably not going anywhere. Like, it's tough to break through. And I don't think the Bulls, what they have on paper, looks any better than the teams I just mentioned. But listen, there's nothing wrong with Chicago looking at where they were and under a recently hired front office within the last 2 years and saying, we haven't won a playoff series since 2015. And until this past season, until this a couple months ago, they hadn't even made the playoffs since 2017. And so just getting a respectable, fun team with some upside and some new faces, I'm not mad at that. Like, that's not a bad strategy. Try to be good first before you can be great. If we start judging this team or any other based solely on, well, there's no championship potential, well, you know, then you're in that polarized view of the NBA where they're either contending or rebuilding, tanking. And the Bulls decided to take kind of a middle path. Let's just get to be good again. Let's just try to remind people what winning feels like. And they've got some fun players. And look, maybe they trade Vucevic, and maybe they find other ways to improve around the edges. But I would say, too, like, benefit of the doubt for them is, as you mentioned, Lonzo Ball didn't finish the season, and Alex Caruso missed a ton of time, too, because of the injury. With Caruso and Lonzo Ball, again, presuming full health in a full season, and a re-signed Zach LaVine, I don't know if they're breaking the top four, but could they finish fifth and pull a first-round upset in the 5-4 matchup? Maybe. Like they're really good. And if Zach LaVine's going to leave, going to Portland, which was a disaster last year and has completely overhauled the roster, like, Dame Lillard's great. And assuming Dame Lillard gets back to 100%, I'm sure it's attractive to play next to Dame, but Do the Blazers have better upside than the Bulls?
How does that make the Blazers?
Like, where is he going? Where is he going with better upside?
I don't think there is a place with better upside as a team. Like, you plug him into Portland, and how much different are the Blazers than they were with CJ McCollum? Like, that, you know, Anthony Simons presumably keeps improving, and maybe you have a nice little three-guard rotation there, but I don't look at that elevating Portland, even into the playoffs, frankly, in the Western Conference, which, as we've talked about a lot, is going to be grueling. Sacramento, I think, is a team on the rise right now, despite the fact they are the Kings. If you can get De'Aaron
Rise-ish.
Fox back, rise-ish. But, you know, but you plug Zach LaVine into that group, and they're not bad. Like, and they've got some upside there. San Antonio kind of is in that weird quasi rebuilding mode themselves. I don't know. I just wonder. To me, it's more about what do the Bulls offer. Like, if they go straight, you know, max, then it's a done deal. Like, Zach LaVine comes back, he gets his money, he's back in a place familiar with, that he had a lot of success in. He comes back. I just wonder if the Bulls will offer that type of money to him.
Well, so, I would say this, too. Given where they've been and not been, and given Zach LaVine's... I mean, look, the guy's 27 years old, just starting his prime, and has been a phenomenal player the last couple of years, and is I think, only going to get better, and certainly has room to improve defensively, especially. But you're not letting him walk for nothing. So if he decides he wants to be somewhere else, or if somewhere else decides that they're willing to pay him more than you are, I think you're going the sign-and-trade route. Or you're maybe paying him a little more than you think he's actually worth, just to protect the asset, with the understanding internally that, you know what, we can always flip him later if we think that this has put too much of a ceiling on our long-term success here. So I cannot see the Bulls letting him walk away unless he's determined to be somewhere else.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Couple of things. Brad Stevens held his end-of-season media availability, and listening to it, Howard, it doesn't sound like Brad is going to be aggressive in reshaping the roster in any way, shape, or form. I know it comes as a bitter disappointment to you, who has been trying to shove Marcus Smart out the back door for the better part of the last 2 weeks, but it sounds like, and look,
you are setting a crossover podcast record, crossover podcast record for putting words in my mouth today. This is phenomenal.
I disagree. I'm telling the truth here on the podcast. one thing Brad said, and I want to read the quote during his media availability on Tuesday, was what we did this year on the defensive end of the floor, and when we're at our best sharing the ball offensively, those things are fragile. So just to add doesn't mean that you're not taking something away from the group. The implication being they know what got them to the finals, and that's being a great defensive team. And that would take a hit if you either replace or marginalize in some way Marcus Smart. So I think he'll be back as a point guard. I think that's the right decision. And look, what this team needs is pretty obvious. You need to find somebody on that wing that can be a scorer there. You know, I've said before, they're kind of high on Sam Hauser internally, but you've got to go out there and find someone that can give you 15 to 20-ish minutes per game on the wing. Brad seems to think that guy's on the roster, whether it's Hauser, Aaron Nesmith is a former lottery pick, but those guys haven't done anything at this point. I think if you're the Celtics and you really believe that a championship is within grasp, which you should believe because you were 2 wins away from winning one this year, you've got to do whatever you can with the trade exceptions that you have, with the mid-level exception, to find the guy that fits. Brad Stevens has been excellent at that during his 1 year as president of basketball operations. He knew Al Horford fit. He brought Al Horford back. He knew Derek White would fit. He traded away assets to get Derek White. So he's been willing to do things to find guys that fit. He needs to find one more guy that fits that group. And if he does, I think the Celtics have a great chance of being right back in the finals next year.
Well, let's start with this. No matter what Brad Stevens said or didn't say at his press conference, you and I both know Brad Stevens was not going to actually say anything revealing or indicative of where he's actually going. Like, if he overhauled the roster, like, that would be a surprise, but not because he said we're not making major changes. Like, that's just what you expect Brad Stevens to say. Like, he's not exactly going to be, you know,
I disagree. A lot of GMs in this era are... I take his word as gospel.
What's that?
I take his word as gospel. I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, a lot of GMs are pretty conservative in their public comments. Brad Stevens is at the extreme end of conservative public comments during his entire time as coach and now as GM. So I'm not expecting that anything he said today is truly indicative of anything. I'm sure he's happy with where they are. They were just in the finals in a game 6. Like, why not? You know, why wouldn't you be pretty happy about that breakthrough season? Every front office knows this, though. Like, the second you think, well, we've got it figured out, you know, if you cannot afford to stand still in this league. They know that if the Bucks get healthy, And for that matter, if the Bucks had been healthy, right? Like everybody around the league, I think believes the same. If the Bucks had been healthy, if Chris Middleton had been healthy, the Bucks probably are in the finals instead of the Celtics. That's not a knock on the Celtics. Every season has things that happen. Every season has injuries. You acknowledge them. You don't asterisk them, but you acknowledge them. And if you're the Celtics and you're a realist, and I think Brad Stevens is a realist, you say, well, we might have gotten, you know, had a couple fortunate turns there. What do we need to do to make sure that we can beat them at full strength? And better playmaking, fewer turnovers, more easier shots. Yeah, those things could matter. And I'm not suggesting for a minute now, nor have I previously, that it's about trading Marcus Smart or giving up on Marcus Smart. It's just the idea that I don't know that we have proof that he is your best option as a full-time point guard for this team.
What proof do you need? They were in the finals. What more proof do you need?
And when push came to shove and things got really tight against a really great defense, they're throwing the ball all over the place and stagnating and not able to run an offense. And they
needed somebody
to get them
easier shots.
That's
as much Tatum and Brown's fault it is, Marcus. That's just as much Tatum and Brown. Tatum had the most turnovers of anybody ever in the playoffs. Ever. Is Marcus Smart responsible for them? I don't think so. I think those are Tatum's problems.
Well, it's a collective thing that they had a ton of turnovers as a team. Tatum's turnovers are Tatum's turnovers, but a team with a more organized offense and maybe a stronger lead at point guard is getting guys easier shots so that they're not either forcing shots or forcing passes or getting themselves into jams. Like a well-flowing offense, a smoothly flowing offense, keeps players out of positions where those kinds of turnovers are going to happen. So it's at least part of it. Like all these things are interrelated. That's, you know, it's a five-man game. I don't know the answer is out there, and I don't know how they get there anyway, even if they could find a more pass-oriented point guard who's a steadier hand and has more of a track record as the lead guard. I don't know how they get that guy, even if he's available. So it's almost, it may be a moot point, but like the Celtics have to at least examine some things this summer. You can't just run it back exactly as is.
Sure, you can. Sure. Well, no, not you never assume you're back in the finals. But I believe in the internal growth of the Celtics. I believe Tatum is going to come back a better player. I think Brown is going to come back a better player. I think Grant Williams, who took a huge step forward this year, is going to come back a better player. I think Robert Williams, at full strength, is going to be a better player. The only guy that has the potential to be worse, really, is Al Horford, because he's 36 years old. And I think Al Horford's game is going to age well enough that as long as he takes care of his body, he's going to be this level of player for at least the next year or two. So I don't see any regression within this team. I only see upside with this team. Again, I still think they have to add that wing score. That's got to come from somewhere, somebody that can extend their rotation to like 9 or 10 guys instead of 8 or 9. But I would put my I would turn my phone off if I'm Brad Stevens. I would ignore trade calls from Mike Zarin. I would not have a conversation about shaking up this team unless I was getting insert 25-year-old all-NBA star, unless I was getting Giannis back, basically, in return. That's the only thing that would require me to shake up this team. I just don't believe that. All right.
I mean, I guess the next time we have this Celtics discussion, I'll just need to borrow your shamrock-colored glasses for a few minutes
just saying,
so I can see the
finals,
things that you're seeing. Because
I spent 2 months clobbering Marcus Smart. I'm not doing it anymore. The guy proved himself. He's a finals point guard, defensive player of the year. There's 29 other teams in this league that would love to get their hands on Marcus Smart under a reasonable contract for the next 3 years.
And if they're willing to do that, maybe you should ask them what they're willing to send you back, because maybe it would help you.
You want to send Ja Morant back. You send Ja Morant back, I'll make that deal tomorrow. Other than that, I'm pretty set with Marcus Smart at one. Any thoughts on John Wall picking up his contract option for next year? Like, how does this John Wall thing end? Like, by the way, shout out to all my Rockets listeners out there. I know you're out there because you all hate me. And I get your tweets all the time. But, like, where are you? Where do those Rockets fans that told me that Christian Wood was the answer, you know, a couple of years ago when they signed him from Detroit? You get Boban and the 26th pick in the draft basically back in a trade for Christian Wood, who brought you nothing over 2 years, not in terms of wins. Kevin Porter Jr. is next, I'm sure, with that team. And now you've got the John Wall situation. Can they just waive him? Like, can you just waive him? Nobody's acquiring him. Just cut him. Like, they should have cut him last summer or last February after the trade deadline. Just cut him and end this saga.
They're running down the clock. Like I could see the wheels turning there. You're thinking, if we just waive him now, buy him out, whatever we do, all right, now there is no upside. The only upside is that we've washed our hands of the situation. But we're now down to the last year. He opts in, as of course everybody expected he would. He opts in. You are down to the last year finally. Does anybody want to trade for him at 40 whatever million? Probably not. Is there still a possibility of some multi-team deal where he goes somewhere, Westbrook goes somewhere, and a bunch of other stuff changes? Maybe. You're just leaving those options open. And if none of that comes to pass and you have to go into the season with him and you've still got this, you know, shadow looming over you, and he's obviously, you know, he would like to be set free. He had the opportunity by not picking up his option. Not that anybody should have expected that. But the closer you get to the trade deadline, or the further you get into the season, the less of a burden it is for a team taking it on. You still have to manufacture the cap matching stuff to get it done. But I could see them running out the clock on basically saying at some point he might be of use in some sort of trade, and maybe we should hang on for that purpose. But yeah, I mean, it's excruciating in the meantime.
This summer has to be the clock's got to run out this summer. You can't go to training camp with the question of John Wall, will he or won't he play, hanging over this team. Like, and I see no reason, if they weren't bringing John Wall back last year with Jalen Green and Kevin Porter Jr. and Josh Christopher and guys like that in the backcourt, if they weren't bringing him back last year, why would they bring him back this year? Like, what would be any different this year than last year? And you're going to spend all season kind of battling with him over what kind of role he would have with the team if he did come back. I mean, I understand, fine. He picks up the option. You look at trades potentially this offseason. But you get to, like, September 1st or even August 1st, goodbye. Wave him. Like, just eat the loss. Like, that's it. It's over. And move on. And try to build something without that distraction hanging over you.
It's a fair stance, but, like, I think it's actually hurting John Wall more than it's hurting the Rockets, and that's not to minimize that.
It is hurting John Wall. I agree. It is 100% hurting John Wall. I think it's hurting. It's not like hurting the Rockets, because John Wall wouldn't have made them contender last year. I think it would have contributed to 5 or 6 more wins because he's a
pretty
good
player. And he wasn't really a distraction either, by the way.
No, he wasn't. Look, only when people like me kind of wrote about it and talked about it and, you know, kind of injected myself into that situation down there. But I think you've got to just cut ties for everybody's benefit. Like, John Wall, you know, take a $5 million haircut and sign for a $5 million exception somewhere. Like, get your money back one way or the other. Just find a way out for both these teams. John Wall has missed way too much time in his career due to injuries to miss any more time due to contract issues. Like, it's simple as that. He's over 30 at this point. You got to move forward with this. Move forward with your career, and the Rockets should move forward with their team.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he's hurt the most by this. The NBA is hurt second most by this, because this looks bad to have these kinds of situations coming over and over again in recent years. And then it's the Rockets after that who are hurt. Like, the Rockets are in a rebuilding mode regardless. They're not winning anytime soon. They're going young. John Wall's not part of that plan. I get that. But him being on the roster at that number isn't hurting them to the extent that, like, he's just a non-factor for them, and he's taking up cap room that could go somewhere else, presumably, but you can't do anything about that. And waiving him doesn't recoup that cap room. Waiving him means you're stuck with that on your books until his contract formally expires next July 1st of 2023. So, like, they have no easy way out when it comes to helping their roster. It's either find a trade somehow, some way, if that even exists, or wait a few months and see if a trade comes about when his contract is now shorter. There really is nothing else. Waiving him doesn't get you anything. It doesn't gain you anything. It helps him, and it ends the situation, the standoff, the stalemate, but it doesn't actually move the needle for the Rockets.
No, but it ending the standoff, I think there's some merit to that. And not having him around and moving forward with the team that you're going to be building around has some merit to it. Because you mentioned a trade. Like, say you hold on to him till February. Like, the only way you make a John Wall deal is if you're willing to take back some bad contracts from other teams. Now, maybe you could absorb draft capital with that. That might be helpful for a rebuilding team like the Rockets. But you're going to have to absorb something worse than John Wall, because nobody's acquiring John Wall because they think John Wall is the missing piece to a championship puzzle. They're acquiring him because they'll take $47 million off their books at the end of the year. Like, that's the reason they're going to get him.
Here's,
so,
here's, Here's the one curiosity I have, and this is where we start getting into the speculative weeds. But if you're the Rockets and you're saying, you know what, however small the possibility is, there is still at least some possibility that we could maneuver his contract somewhere and still gain out of this somehow. It makes me wonder, like, if you haven't gotten, as you say, by August 1st, September 1st, a deal, and he's still sitting there, do you take him into the season and say, you know what, screw it, let's play him. Let's bring him back in full capacity. Let's play him and see if there's a team out there that sees him playing at a level that actually makes him look like, okay, still an overpaid player, but at least a positive contributor, an impactful player, as he was for much of his career pre-injuries. And if that happens, maybe there is a market. Also, by the way, as always happens, somebody in October, November, December is going to go down with an injury. Someone's going to be lost for the season, and some team's going to say, crap, well, who's out there? Well, Wall's really expensive, but we only have to pay him for a year or for less than a season. Can we manufacture that deal? So, like, I think those are the scenarios that the Rockets are holding on to as, you know, plausible escapes from this, but it's still months down the road.
Well, the Rockets moving forward. Shout out to the Christian Wood era. Worked out well there in Houston. Well done.
You hate Christian Wood, my God.
I don't hate Christian Wood, but I was just the amount of vitriol I took for, like, suggesting that they shouldn't have signed him and should have kept Trevor Reza, maybe dealt Trevor Reza for something else, back when Trevor Reza still had some value at that point a couple of years ago. It was wild. I never saw Christian Wood as this, you know, winning player at this point. And the Mavericks look, theoretically, Christian Wood works great in Dallas. Can pick and pop player with Luka, you know, offensively. I don't know how it's going to work defensively, but it just didn't make any sense to me for Houston, and it didn't accomplish anything in 2 years while he was there. So that's my take on it. Howard, good stuff, man. We'll do it again next week. And when we come back, my conversation with Jeremy Wu. All right, the NBA draft is just days away, and I will be the first to admit I don't know too much about it. It is not my forte after covering the finals and the playoffs the better part of the last 4 months. Fortunately, over at SI, we have a terrific draft analyst. Jeremy Wu has been all over the NBA draft for months now. His latest big board and mock drafts are up on SI.com as we speak, and Jeremy is back on the podcast. What's up, Jeremy?
Hey, man, I'm good. This week is always kind of crazy, but it has been, like, a little bit less busy than some years. But it's also only, we're taping this Tuesday morning, so it probably will get worse.
plenty of time for it to get worse. All right, yeah. I want to start with the top of the draft. How much ambiguity is there still? How much uncertainty do you think there still is with the top of the draft?
You know, I think there's probably more than there's been in past years. I would attribute some of that to the fact that Orlando and Oklahoma City are both very, very good at not leaking. They are, you know, commendable in terms of the way that they manage information. You know, also, I think the fact that there is legitimate debate, you know, and there has been all year over who should be the number one pick, you know, depending on who you talk to, has also, you know, made it a little bit more uncertain. Having said that, as of this morning, like, I feel pretty good that Orlando is going to take Jabari Smith at number one. You know, I don't think they've necessarily, like, made that final call, but it would still, I think, at this point, surprise me if it were not him, based on what I've heard. And, you know, he's been my number one prospect all year. So, you know, for me, you know, that's something that makes sense. So I don't question it too much because I think he's going to be really, really good. Now, I think the actual uncertainty begins with Oklahoma City at number two. Where I think right now people think they will take Chet Holmgren, which makes a lot of sense in a lot of different ways. I think that's where Chet wants to go. I do think there's an outside chance that they do something unexpected and take Paolo Banchero, but I don't know that that's the likely outcome, just based on sort of the vibe that you hear about what is going on behind the scenes with that situation. And then Banchero would then go number three. I think Houston is prepared to take whichever one of those two guys falls. So there is uncertainty, and there are scenarios that I would believe, like, people entertaining. Like, for example, like, if, like, just say you're Houston, like, you need to at least have a contingency in place and know what you're going to do if something unexpected happens, right? And some years it doesn't feel like that. So that's how I'd characterize it. Like, we don't know for sure, but at least we have, I think, a sense now.
Well, why, go back to Jabari Smith for a minute there. Why has he separated himself as number one? Did you feel like he was number one, you know, for the last few months, or have things evolved to put him in that position?
Yeah, I put Jabari number one in December after I saw him live. Like, the day I saw him, I was like, I think this is the guy. And the more you learn about him, and, you know, I spent some time at Auburn, and I saw them play like four times this year. And I, you know, I did a feature on Jabari for our site. So I'd like to think that I am not biased and just like more familiar with, you know, who he is than some people. But he just is what you want in terms of somebody who can be, you know, an elite talent who also is, you know, an incredible person whose teammates are going to like, and you can set a culture and like build a team around a guy like that. Like, he really is what you want. And I think not enough is made about the fact that he is, you know, potentially a generationally good jump shooter. Like, his mechanics are incredible. They're very consistent. I have not seen a teenager shoot like that. And again, he's a whole year younger than Chet Holmgren, like, which does matter in the context of the draft. Like, there could be like a huge leap ahead for him. Like, think about, you know, Anthony Edwards, you know, took a big jump, and he was young for his class too. So like, you know, just the way I put it to some people is like, let's just imagine that if we sent Jabari back to college and let him play at Gonzaga next year, at the same age Chet was, this year, what do we think it would look like? And he'd probably average 30 a game. So like, you got to really take that into account. But, you know, for me, just, you know, his defense, his intangibles, the shooting totally outweighs the issue of, you know, how good of a ball handler is he? Because it's so hard to block his shot that I think all he has to do is just be efficient with one or two dribbles, and he's going to get those shots. And again, like, people, you know, have varying opinions in the mid-range shot, which is fair. But at the end of the day, when you're trying to win a game, sometimes the mid-range shot is what you want and what you have to take. And it's in the playoffs, it's what it boils down to sometimes, right? So I'd rather have a guy who's really, really good at that and can learn other stuff. But like, I feel good about him, you know, taking those shots at the end of the game, rather than someone who, you know, again, we've seen this get Giannis into trouble sometimes. And this is not like a knock on Giannis, but just like someone who has to bail to the rim and get fouled maybe when there's pressure, right? The jumper is a big separator.
So I learned a lot about Chet Holmgren from reading our colleague Greg Bishop's feature on him over on SI.com this week. What's the word on him at this point? You didn't mention him as one of the top three picks you're looking at right now. What's been the buzz on him over the last couple of months?
Yeah, so he's fourth on my big board, but it's not like I think he's going to be a bust. I think there are like easier pathways for Smith, Bencaro, and Ivy to, you know, become stars. And I think it kind of just kind of comes down to like, at the end of the day, Chet's a really, really good defensive prospect with offensive upside. But how many defensive prospects have we seen that have really like changed that, you know, really changed the NBA like that? I mean, Gobert was super impactful and no one expected it. But there's a lot of ways to build a good defense that can work in the playoffs, right? So I think just because the fact Chet is so unique makes him more of an acquired taste, but is totally someone who you can justify taking at, you know, one or two. I wouldn't take him over Jabari. And again, I have him fourth, but there are people who, you know, do have him one. There are people who, you know, really love him. And I think, you know, to his credit, I mean, he is a really good player. So, you know, you can nitpick the body. I don't think he's going to be like too skinny for the NBA. I just think there are going to be certain things that don't translate as well. But
like, again, what, for example?
Well, you know, I think it's hard to see him being like a really, really good rebounder right away, just because he's going to get moved off his spot really easily. Like, you saw that in the games they played against, you know, more physical teams. It doesn't mean he's necessarily a bad rebounder, but it's just something that's going to be harder for him. You know, I'm curious to see, you know, offensively what else he has to his game that Gonzaga didn't let him show. Like, I know he can put it on the floor. You know, I think he's a pretty good shooter. I think he'll, you know, be able to make jumpers. But they didn't really let him like unleash that. You know, it would have been interesting to see him in a situation there where they let him, you know, play as a guard. But I question a little bit the foot speed. It's kind of a high handle, like whether he can really do that in traffic, whether you can use him like that. But again, there's a lot to like. Like, he's going to be an impactful defender. It's going to be, you know, when he's at the rim rotating over, it's going to be hard to score on him. He's got great instincts, really, really good understanding. And again, it really helps that on offense, he at least like knows how to play with teammates. So like, even if he's not an offensive focal point, it's not like he's going to be a negative. Like, he's going to be a guy who can space the floor and attack a closeout and, you know, make a play in a pinch, right? But when I talk about upside in the NBA, it's just like, if you look at, you know, a lot of it's really just tied to offense, and I would just take the elite shooter 10 times out of 10. And I'm convinced Jabari is, you know, the best shooting prospect in this draft and in many drafts past. So
Chet is, I saw him at the lottery. He is the skinniest prospect I've ever seen. Like, he just is. And that might be hyperbole for me because I haven't seen every prospect, but he is really thin. Like, when you talk to NBA teams about his body type and what that's going to develop into and what kind of potential issue that could be, if at all, like, what's the word back on that?
Yeah. I think what you'll hear is, like, and I think this is a fair point, like, how many players have really been, like, too skinny for the NBA? Like, again, there are guys who are limited by their frames, and there are guys who are, like, outliers in that way. But it's never been a problem for him to this point, right? Like, he's been very effective in spite of it. But again, I think on the flip side, even think about a guy like Brandon Ingram, who is very skinny, obviously a very different player, but it did take Brandon like 5 years to become a physically mature player. Now he's an awesome player, right? But like, it does take time. And
little different though at that spot though, right? Like, to your point, sure, like, you know, Brandon Ingram as a wing guy can afford to be a little skinnier. Chet Holmgren has a five or a four in some situations.
Exactly.
I mean, he's going to have to get that lower body strong.
Exactly. And look, it's not like, I don't think any of us are under the illusions that this is a league where you throw it into the post 20 times a game anymore, right? So it's like, he's not going to get exposed necessarily like that, but it's just more of like in the run of play when you're that light and you can get bumped off your spot and it's like hard to hold ground. And again, I think one thing that's just a little scary is just that he's always been a little bit older and always been, you know, had a huge physical advantage at every level, right? Like whether he played at Gonzaga, whether he played at Duke, it would have been the same. Like he would have had a big physical advantage with his length. The only way that you ever find out, you know, what the NBA is like, is you get to the NBA, right? There's no way to replicate that. And so I think when we see someone who is unique in that way, just naturally there's reason to, you know, question that. Like, it's reductive to be like, oh, he's too skinny. But there, again, this is something that I've said all year, and I think that's the main point that has to be made, is that yes, like, you know, you have to nitpick a little bit about the body because you also can't, it's a big part of why he's so good too, right? So it's like, let's say we were sure Chet could add 30 pounds. Would that help? Like, would that help him? Would he lose some of the mobility that makes him so unique? And I don't know the answer to that. And it just makes it harder to project, right? It's just harder to know.
Yeah. At the lottery, I was talking to an executive from a team that finished outside of the top three, a lottery team executive. And I was asking him, are you disappointed? He didn't move up. He didn't advance. He's like, not really. We look at this draft as being eight deep. We really think there are eight players that are going to be impact type players. You know, look, that's just one executive saying that. And he's obviously saying it, you know, with some self-interest in mind. He's hoping it's eight deep at that point. But the depth of this draft, what's been the word on that, and how deep do impact players go?
Yeah. So the way that I would frame it is, you know, obviously I think it can only be interpreted to me as a good thing that there are, you know, four people you could argue for at number one, right? Because if those guys are all at least, you know, have all-star outcomes that create some degree of depth where you're at least happy with what you're walking away with. Now, there's not like a transcendent Zion in this draft where it's like everyone's head over heels, like in that way. Like, obviously I love Jabari Smith, but it's not the same. It's not the same. Like, everybody just unanimously agrees. But I think, like, look, I can get to about 10 or 12 guys who I think would be good prospects in any draft where like you're looking at them as, you know, maybe some of the guys in this draft who will go 8, 9, 10 might be more like 12, 13, 14 in a deeper draft. There might just, you know, might be a different, you know, levels of stratification of the talent, but like these are good players. And I think with any draft, like when we're talking about quality of depth, like we should really only talk about the 15 to 20 players anyway, because after that it's so fit based and we always see guys succeed every year who we don't expect. But I think the tricky thing with this draft, and I've said this before too, is just that like once you get to about maybe 15 or 16, it's really, really hard to do the rankings. Like I had a really hard time just figuring out who to put where, because again, I'm not ranking for a team. I don't know who I'm bidding for, so it's harder. But in that respect, like it does create some depth, because if you're picking at 35 to 40, you might get a player who's as good as whoever goes, you know, 20 to 25. Like that does create depth. It's just a matter of how good are those guys. And I think that's what everybody's wondering. So like, I hate to label a draft good or bad, because it's, again, we are always wrong. Because we don't know, because so much of success in the NBA is where do you land and how much does that team love you and give you the right ingredients to succeed. And we just can't know that yet. So that's kind of where the disagreement lies. But I do say that I wish I felt better about, you know, 15 to 45. I'll put it like that.
So speaking of that range, look, we saw in the finals that you know, you get there and championships are won because of the success drafting in that post-lottery range. I mean, the Celtics with Robert Williams and Peyton Pritchard and Grant Williams all drafted in the 20s, impact players for that team. Golden State obviously has the gold standard with Draymond Green being a second-round pick, but they've also drafted guys over the years, Jordan Poole being one of them, Kevon Looney, that have not been surefire, you know, top draft picks. When you look at the 15 to 45 type range, who do you like? Like, who do you really like to come out as an impact player?
Yeah. So, like, in that giant, like, tier of players, like, some of the guys who I have higher, maybe who people don't like as much, like, Wendell Moore from Duke is one of them. I just think he's good at a lot of stuff. And it's really rare that we see a Duke guy get, like, underrated. But he kind of just became that, I think, because his, you know, so much of what he did was subtle and he was, you know, accentuating the other guys that they had. But he was really the glue that held that team together. And he played really well. I saw Duke, I think, five times, and he was good in, you know, I think four of the five games. I think that's kind of a trend with this draft where you see guys who, like Wendell is someone who probably can defend three positions, can play a little bit on the ball, can shoot a little bit, has the physical tools where he's long and has some heft and can, you know, is going to be able to hold up physically. Those types of guys are really, really valuable right now, particularly in the playoffs, because it gives you some versatility with matchups and skill sets, and you can kind of play them in different lineup combinations. So, like, look, if you look at the guys like who are rising, it's like him and Jalen Williams from Santa Clara has had a really big rise in the last 6 weeks. I think it was just kind of like a well-kept secret. It wasn't like a total shock, right? So, like, those guys do some of the same stuff where they are lineup connectors who can shoot and dribble and pass. Dyson Daniels says his stock has gone up because he's really good at those things. So that's kind of the role player that's in vogue right now, because it allows you to, you know, play different ways and win in contexts. That's someone I feel good about. It's kind of, I think, a trend with this draft is like the big versatile wing guys, like Jake LaRavia, you know, who's going to go probably in the 20s is someone who kind of you can make that argument for.
Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, in the lottery range, who's someone you think is being overrated at this point? Because they're always there. I mean, as much as we love to praise teams for who they drafted, I mean, in that lottery range, at least half of them turn out to be non-players this year. As you look at that kind of lottery range, who do you not like? Who do you think is getting a little bit too much credit at this point?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, this is probably in line with some of the guys who might fall a little bit, sort of for these same reasons, but like, I think Shaedon Sharpe is one, obviously a really, really interesting situation. Going to be a great case study as a guy who didn't play at all in college, but, you know, was at Kentucky on the bench hanging out and practiced and, hasn't been hanging out. Yeah. He's been okay in workouts. Like, he hasn't been great. I think he hasn't necessarily answered the questions people had about the motor, but the tools are amazing. Right. But like, I think one of the strengths of this draft is that there are a lot of guys in the lottery who are like solid, reliable people, with very easy skill sets to understand that make sense. You know, you got the Johnny Davises and the Dyson Daniels and Jeremy Sohan and Ben Mathurin. Like, these are guys who are going to be like reliable pros who I think, you know, people feel good about. But you know, when you talk about like a Shaedon or like, I think AJ Griffin is one who may fall a little bit just cause, you know, partially cause of the medical situation, like, people are questioning that, you know, his health history, and his mobility and how much he'll be able to sort of maintain. And then even like a Jalen Duren who, you know, he's got the argument of, well, how high do you really want to pick a center who doesn't shoot? Definitely an interesting player, doesn't have a great motor. Like, those are the types of guys who I think we'll probably see go back half of the lottery, but who I just feel less good about, you know, delivering that value maybe.
Last thing I want to ask you about, Michael Rosenberg, our colleague, has a piece up on SI.com about, what's his last name? Armando, the kid from North Carolina. I'm blanking on his last name.
Armando Bacot.
Bacot, yeah, Armando Bacot, who went back to school in part because he can get a huge chunk of cash from NIL money. Have you seen that had an impact on this draft beyond Armando Bacot? And do you see NIL money having an impact on early entry candidates moving forward?
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, I think it's kind of hard to say, but in the case of Bacot, I think he kind of fits the trend, particularly with guys who are centers. It's become a nice little windfall where, like, look, you're seeing the NBA go away from the traditional back for basket bigs, But you've got the Baycotts and Oscar Shibuyes and guys like that who, you know, are probably second round picks at best, but they can go back to college and actually make more money now, right? So it's probably going to change the way the college game is played a little bit, because I think you'll see the, you know, those traditional bigs will understand the value of staying in school and making money and being successful. But then again, you know, you had Kofi Coburn turn pro anyway and leave Illinois this year, I think was just, you know, didn't feel like he needed to be in college anymore. So like, the actual trend will take a little bit of time to play out. I think ultimately, like, a lot of the guys who are going to go back are going to be the fringe players anyway, because most kids, when they know that they're going to, you know, they can feel good about being a first round pick with guaranteed money, they're going to take that chance. And I would tell them, take that chance. I'm very curious to see, you know, as this continues to play out, like, how many guys on the borderline are end up coming back for those reasons.
Yeah. And more than that, especially for the high end guys. And I always say this, cause what I know about this is just this, that it's not about the guaranteed money early. It's about getting to that second contract. Every NBA player wants to get that second contract quicker. That's why it's better to come out at 18 than 19, because by the time you're 22, 23, it's just one extra contract you can get before the end of your career. So I tend to agree with you. I think maybe it is more the fringy guys. Centers is a good point. That makes a lot of sense, especially guys that don't shoot the ball particularly well. But the wing players, the blue chip prospects, they're always going to choose the NBA. Even if in that first year of an NIL deal, hypothetically, they were making more money than the first year of an NBA deal, it's all about that second contract. Get to that second contract where the real money starts to flow in.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, you make the point about wings. People have made that to me too. It's like, if you just look at the turnover every year, like, you know, wings end up making the leap and because they're always in demand. And then wings we don't know about will make a jump next year. There are always going to be guys who, you know, raise their stock. It's harder if you're a point guard or you're a center, because it's just it's a narrower projection in terms of position and demand, you know. But for
no question,
versatile guys, it's different.
No question. Well, Jeremy, you can follow Jeremy's stuff over at SI.com all week long through Thursday's draft. I'll be covering that for us over at SI.com. Keep up the good work, man, and enjoy the next few days as best you can.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.